Israel Report with Rolene Marks for the latest information and the stories behind the news.
Rolene Marks, how are you?
I'm good, in yourself, Howard?
Excellent, thank you. We've tried a very, very nice whiskey today. We gave
I'm
one.
I'm hearing so.
Yeah, we
I'm
gave
so.
Much. We gave one away to one lucky listener, but I'm just getting it here so I can tell you. It's called the Epicurean. It's a lowland blended malt whiskey. Very, very nice indeed.
I'm now Epicurious.
Absolutely, and so you should be. Tell us about a bus refusing a White House call. That sounds very mature.
Well, you know, nothing like a little tantrum to make sure that you get your own way. So apparently he refused a White House phone call as ties between the Palestinian Authority and the U.S. continue to sour over the closing of the PLO mission to Washington. So apparently he refused to speak to White House officials on the phone, and the call was actually supposed to coordinate a meeting that is upcoming, and Haaretz newspaper cited a senior official saying that they did not take the call and they did not say when the aborted call took place. But on Tuesday, the Palestinian foreign minister, Riyad al-Malki, said he had been instructed by President Abbas to put ties with Washington on ice, and their response to the Washington potentially closing down their office without further notifications is they have said that in practice, by closing the office, they are freezing all meetings, and we are making that official. Now, we have heard from the White House, who have said that this is not accurate. They said that there will be conversations taking place, and that they are in contact with Palestinian officials about the status of the PLO office in Washington, and also not just about that, but of course about larger efforts on the ground to try and broker some kind of lasting and comprehensive peace. So we're hearing two different reports, one coming from the White House, one coming from the Palestinian Authority. But perhaps this is a lesson for the White House to learn, that when the Palestinians want to be stubborn, boy, oh boy, can they be stubborn and dig their heels in very, very, very hard. And also, another one of the issues that Washington has with the Palestinian Authority is that the Palestinian Authority wanting to go to the International Criminal Court and open investigations and to prosecute Israeli officials for their involvement in so-called settlement activities and aggressions against Palestinians, and that is using the terminology that the Palestinians are using. So President Trump now has 90 days to consider whether the Palestinians are in direct and meaningful negotiations with Israel, and judging by this kind of behavior, I think that the American president is going to be very, very frustrated.
Wow. Absolutely fascinating to keep an eye on how these situations develop. Tell us about Pence addressing Knesset.
I mean, you know, as we're talking about Mahmoud Abbas, I just have visions of him in the aisle of a supermarket having an epic tantrum. I don't know, but it's just the
absurdity of it. You'd think for somebody who considers themselves to be a politician, a global politician or a serious politician, this is something beyond words.
And at his age, and with the number of years that he has been in power ruling the West Bank or the Palestinian Authority, he would ostensibly be the elder statesman, and he's behaving like a naughty two-year-old.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible. Moving on to Pence and Knesset.
Well, on more positive note, the U.S. Vice President Mike Pence will be visiting Israel in mid-December. He coincides with Hanukkah, and also he apparently plans to speak to a lot of Christian organizations. And he offered to address the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, and this, of course, was immediately snapped up by the Knesset. And he'll be the first top-level U.S. official to address addressed the Knesset since George W. Bush in 2008. So he arrives on the December the 18th, and of course there will be formal ceremonies to receive him, and he will then go to the Knesset and make his address. And it is speculated that he will speak about the alliance between Israel and America, and speak about the regional threat posed by Iran. And during this time, well, I mean, we'll see how things play out. I don't think they will be happening if Mahmoud Abbas continues to be a sulking toddler, but he will be meeting with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and President Mahmoud Abbas. And this is according to the White House, but it remains to be seen. And then from there, he will travel to Egypt, and he will meet with President al-Sisi, and he will speak with him about U.S. and Egyptian cooperation.
And certainly we'll keep an eye on that tour. A Kuwaiti writer has said that Israel is not an occupier. It's a legitimate state. This is a turnaround.
This is a huge turnaround. I mean, when I saw this, it was like, you know, stop the press, slam on the bricks, put the needle on the record. What is all this all about? And a Kuwaiti writer, his name is Abdullah Al-Hadlak, he was speaking on Kuwait's Al-Rai TV channel, and he said that the Jewish state is both independent and sovereign. And he actually challenged the Arab states, the multiple Arab states' solidarity against Israel. And this was on Sunday, and he said, like it or not, Israel is an independent and sovereign state. It exists. It has a seat at the United Nations. Most peace-loving and democratic countries recognize it. And those that don't recognize Israel, and are you listening, our friends out there with all the acronyms? How would we know they are?
No,
we
they
know
definitely they listen. Are. They're, no, they definitely do. They enjoy the show.
They do enjoy the show. Our pleasure to entertain them. But anyway, he goes on to say that countries of tyranny and oppression are those that don't recognize the state of Israel. I mean, this is quite incredible. And he went on to express a lot of admiration for Israel. He says he admires the Jewish state's values, its institutions. He actually specifically spoke about the 2011 prisoner swap with the Gilad Shalit, where Israel exchanged over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners for Gilad Shalit. And he said, you know, that this is an example that Israel places on the value of its citizens. And he says that, how would... you and I couldn't have written a better statement. I mean, he goes on to say that when the state of Israel was established in 1948, there was no state called Palestine. And he says there's no occupation. There is a people returning to its promised land, and the land of Israel was promised to the Jews by Allah. And he says that the Palestinians are doing themselves no great justice because they can't continue to place themselves in a position of victimhood, and they don't want to recognize the state of Israel, and this does not bode well for the Palestinians. And he says the next thing we need to do is, and these are his words, annihilate Hezbollah.
What's fascinating to me about this is I often wonder, when you see pieces like this starting to emerge, I just wonder if somebody like this is writing it. It appears obviously that he's writing it off his own bat, but you do just wonder if there is a he's not trying to get a sense on behalf, let's say, of government or of a political party, just to get a sense of what the reaction to this type of gesture is. Was there a reaction to the piece? Do we know of any reaction from within
Kuwait? But I do think that you do have a fair point, because I think that there's a lot of effort now in trying to normalize the idea of ties between Israel and certain Gulf countries. And, you know, pardon the terrible pun, but we do see a Gulf appearing within the Arab League, those that support Iran and those that are more lean. You know, we have the Sunni, Shia, axes, sorry. So it's very, very interesting, and often those of us who are engaged in strategies against BDS and against those who call for the destruction of Israel, say that Israel's not a legitimate state, we often say that these kind of people are anti-normalization, they're anti-peace. And this is such evidence of a concentrated effort to normalize relations. I mean, you know, it's just such a much better spending of energy in trying to promote a peace and normalization within the region.
Well, can you imagine if all of the foreign aid that was sent to the region was actually used to build schools and hospitals and used for peace rather than being poured literally into the ground to build tunnels that could be used for terror? Can you just imagine for one moment if that money was spent to build Gaza and not destroy it?
It would be unbelievable. I mean, and think about, we have incredible programs in schools. I know some schools spot very, very smart children very early, and these kids are basically made for life. I mean, we'll go into units like Shmone Matayim, which are the cyber units. They'll go into Modi'in, the intelligence unit, and they will come out of that, and there will be these incredible startup entrepreneurs. Wouldn't it be amazing if the same philosophy of concentrating on development and entrepreneurship and growing that side of things was spent in the territories instead of education for aid? Imagine saying to your kids, you can be an entrepreneur, you can be a ballet dancer, you can be whatever you want. Imagine that energy instead of become a shahid, become a martyr. The more Jews you kill, the better for us all, and we'll receive a stipend. I bet you that the amount of profit made by good entrepreneurship will far outweigh a monthly stipend on terror.
And Sian saying, I think that the Arab media have started producing more pro-Israel content to start getting the population of those countries to be more accepting of normalization with the only true democracy in the Middle East. I tend to agree with that. That's my sense that I'm getting from this, is that the slow infiltration, but that's a negative word, a slow trial of more positive responses to and around Israel in the Arab press.
Imagine some other press followed suit, Howard.
Yeah, I'll take the Star, for example. Finally, before we let you go, first evidence of Israel treating Syrian victims of chemical attacks.
Well, this is also another incredible story, and you and I spoke a couple of days ago about the footage that we hadn't seen footage. You know, we've heard a lot of the stories. We've had a lot of people visit hospitals like Ziv Hospital and meet some of the Syrians that have been rescued by IDF or have been to field hospitals. We know of Israel's incredible humanitarian aid for Syrian civilians. And the other day, for the first time, footage of these mothers with their children coming into Israel for help was screened. And now we've heard for the first time, and this is from three Syrian rebels who have been wounded in chemical weapons attacks by the Syrian regime. They have spoken about receiving treatment. And we've heard from various people in the military that, yes, Israel has treated several Syrians who have been affected by chemical warfare. We know that many journalists have tried to contact Ziv Hospital to see what they have to say, and Ziv has not responded to that. But we have now heard that the Syrian forces shelled strategic sites which have been controlled by the rebels, and this site is called Badaya Hill, and that three of these rebels who suffered suffocation as a result of these chemical gas attacks were sent to Israel. And what we also know from them is that Assad is pushing more of an offensive, and you know, it's really, really quite incredible. And the intelligence minister Yisrael Katz, who spoke about aiding children who were victims of chemical weapons, you know, we heard of this earlier this year in Khan Shakhyun, which is a region in northern Syria. He said it is our obligation secessionist Jews and Israelis to provide assistance to those wounded in gas attacks in Syria, especially those that are children. So really, really incredible. I mean, the stories are horrendous, and it really, it hits at our very kishkes, because we know the effect of what this is like. And unfortunately, according to Human Rights Watch, the Chemical Weapons Convention does not ban the use of chlorine, and the Assad regime is using chlorine amongst other gases on its civilians.
It's a horror that that is quite beyond belief that this has been allowed to continue. I mean, I'm trying to remember how long back it was that Obama stood up and he spoke about the red line, and if he had proof of Syria using Assad using chemical warfare, then I don't know, he was going to send a strongly worded letter. But he implied that he was going to do more than that, and here we are years and years later, and we still are seeing the product of it, and it's still happening, and yet it's just bizarre.
Well, I remember very clearly. In fact, I'm next to my office is next to my bomb shelter, and in my bomb shelter are the gas masks. Because I remember very, very clearly getting a directive from our home front command to go get our gas masks, and we were preparing drills. We were preparing in case there should be spillover to this great American retaliation for chemical attacks. And as you said, he sent a strongly worded letter, or perhaps a meme or something to Assad, but nothing happened, and nobody was more astounded than us in Israel.
Yep, absolutely horrific. On that sad note, that's where we leave it. Time is 5:54. That's Rolene Marks with the Israel Report, Monday to Thursday, around about 5:35. Rolene, you have a fantastic weekend. Shabbat Shalom. Again, another very intense, newsy week. Hopefully, you'll be able to unplug over Shabbat, relax, and we'll catch up with you on Monday. But you are joining the Morning Mayhem tomorrow morning?
Of course, it wouldn't be a weekend if I don't create some chaos.
All right. Causing Mayhem on the Morning Mayhem, Rolene Marks. You can listen to her tomorrow morning. It's 5:54.